Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. And if you're listening today, we're still off the air on the radio dial due to the severe weather that's damaged the transmitter. You can donate at knsj.org to help us get back on the air. And thanks for listening on the live stream to those of you who are tuned in today. We open our show today with a warning about another storm slamming into our region that the National Weather Service warns is one of the most severe on record, bringing heavy snow to our mountains and flooding elsewhere in the region, with yet more wet weather coming after that. Our newsmaker interview today is with Bill Powers, an engineer from the Protect Our Communities Foundation. We'll be talking about San Diego County's proposed regional decarbonization framework. Find out what important facts were left out of the county report, how it could negatively impact communities in our region if adopted by supervisors, and why the report's author has a conflict of interest. Next up from Public News Service, we'll have some national news stories, including why that Ohio train wreck that contaminated the region could have been prevented, new sanctions imposed by President Joe Biden regarding the Ukraine war, and some troubling news on the rise in gun violence. SDG&E wants to raise your rates, a lot, over each of the next 4 years. Find out why and how you can make your voice heard in several upcoming hearings that the California Public Utilities Commission is holding, including one here in San Diego. Now, if you rode the trolley in East County or San Diego in the last half of 2022, you may have been exposed to tuberculosis or TB. We'll have details on our show today. On Sounds of History, learn about contributions of black settlers in the early days of Julian, our historic gold rush town, as we commemorate Black History Month. We'll also have an update on some major events postponed to new dates because of this severe weather forecast, including Lemon Grove's Black History Celebration, the county's Love Your Heart Community Fair in Ramona, Santee's Fido Fest, and Lakeside's Touch a Truck event. And finally, from California News Service, we'll have a report on how gazing at digital screens too long may be harming your vision. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with a severe storm warning. Treacherous, severe, really dangerous conditions. Those are terms used by National Weather Service meteorologist Alex Tardy in a webinar to describe a slow-moving atmospheric river coupled with high winds and frigid temperatures from an Arctic jet stream. It's all swooping into San Diego County Friday and Saturday, February 24th and 25th. This storm could dump a potentially unprecedented 3 to 5 feet of snow at elevations over 4,000 feet in some parts of Southern California, including another foot and a half forecast on Mount Laguna, on top of considerable snow that's already fallen there. Also forecast are debris flows in areas not normally subject to them as snow melts. Blowing and drifting snow will impact major Southern California highways, including Highway 78 and the eastern parts of Interstate 8 in San Diego County. In addition to urban and small stream flooding countywide, the San Diego River is also forecast to surpass flood level, over 10 feet. Along the coast, 30 to 40 mile an hour winds could topple trees, and inland, gusts up to 60 miles an hour may occur, while heavy rains are forecast even in desert areas. The National Weather Service has issued its first ever blizzard warning for mountains in neighboring San Bernardino County and for the San Gabriel Mountains. Highway 2, the main route to Big Bear and Lake Arrowhead, has already been shut down in anticipation of the snow. Now, the most dangerous period will be from Friday through noon Saturday, with the heaviest rains forecast around 2 to 3 a.m. on Saturday. Tardy says everywhere will have problems, noting that in some areas this is a purple-level storm, extreme. Now, our county here in San Diego will dry out on Sunday and Monday. That's the good news. And if you are driving to see the snow in the mountains, please be careful. Parking will be limited. They expect snow jams, and they ask that people not block traffic or go sledding on graves in the cemetery, as some people have done in the past. But Another cold storm front is set to slam into the region at the end of February and the beginning of March, bringing a high probability of really wet conditions and cold temperatures continuing across Southern California into early next month. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. And today, my very special guest is Bill Powers. He is a prominent engineer and a board member on the Protect Our Communities Foundation. That's a nonprofit that supports clean energy solutions, defends the environment, and promotes affordable electricity rates. Based in East County, the group was founded originally to oppose Sunrise PowerLink high voltage transmission lines, and it has since utilized advocacy and legal channels to fight for clean energy that protects communities and opposing industrial scale wind and solar projects in the backcountry that can be destructive of ecosystems and the quality of life for residents out there. So today we are here to talk about the County of San Diego's regional decarbonization framework and why the Protect Our Communities Foundation, as well as many rural community planning groups, are taking a stand to oppose the county's plan as it's written. Bill, welcome to the show. It's great to see you again.
Thank you, Miriam. Thank you very much for inviting me to be here.
Now, the county describes its decarbonization framework as a science-based, holistic approach to guide the region's decarbonization efforts in partnership with UC San Diego's School of Global Policy and Strategy and USD's Policy Initiative Center. The goal of decarbonization is to help stop climate change. I think we probably all agree that's a worthy goal. And you yourself, I know, have supported the concept of clean energy. We're not opposed to that. So can you sum up for us, what's wrong with the county's plan in your view?
Sure. Well, a little bit of background is that a lot of entities are putting out a lot of plans all the time. And the Protect Our Communities Foundation is a pretty small group. And so a lot of times we're not in on the ground floor on some of these issues. They come to us, and we actually jumped into pushing against a major solar farm proposed in Hukumba Hot Springs in the summer of 2021.
Yes, and we were reporting on that battle early on before the county ultimately approved it, last I had heard. But it hasn't broken ground yet, is that right?
Right. It's still up in the air because I think more of financing of the power purchase agreement and some of the more legal administrative details. So it hasn't started, but we were pushing back on that as just another example of pushing renewable energy out into the backcountry and rural areas when the utility is opposing putting solar on rooftops and parking lots in a painless way that would achieve decarbonization faster and more effectively and more democratically. And so it was really working with the folks in Hukumba that said, hey, are you aware of this regional decarbonization framework process is getting started? But we weren't, and then just started to track it, I think, in late 2021, early 2022, and then realized that, hey, this is basically the plan. This is basically
fast-tracking, correct? Or maybe even allowing waivers of certain environmental review in order to push through some of these big energy projects.
Correct. And it, you know, I reviewed it and could see that it is really just, to me, it was San Diego Gas and Electric's preferred strategy with a county cover on it. And that we started digging into the numbers, and the numbers were skewed. They were wrong. And that's where we've been at, is pushing back on, if you have factually accurate information in this document, you are not proposing a strategy that paves the backcountry with solar and wind plants. You're putting it in town, and you're not building expensive transmission lines.
Let's dig into some of the details on this, Bill. So you say the county's plan uses the wrong transmission cost when it asserts that remote wind and solar is the least costly way to reduce our carbon footprint. And you say that it's rooftop and parking lot solar. And yet the county completely omitted the $3.9 billion cost of proposed transmission lines from Imperial County to hook up about 2,000 megawatts of solar and wind power that would be imported from these remote areas. Why do you think the county left that out? And how much difference would it have made if they included that high cost of these building all these transmission lines in the equation when determining that rooftop and parking lot solar wasn't the way to go?
Yeah, and there's a couple of things going on here, but had they included that cost accurately, it would have flipped the script. The lower cost resource would be solar in the city on rooftops and parking lots.
Yeah. And you've actually crunched these numbers. This is not just, you know, pie in the high sky conclusions. I know you've sent me some of the numbers, and they do seem to pan out.
Right. I mean, when you spend $4 billion on a transmission line to move 2,000 megawatts, you're adding a lot of cost onto those megawatts. And the interesting thing here, Miriam, is that information is in the report, meaning in two portions of the report, they say the transmission will cost $3.9 billion, but they don't use that number. They use a small number for a local project here in San Diego and just say it's almost as if it's a bingo and someone's reaching in to grab a number out of a bowl, and whatever number comes out, as long as it's low, they'll use it.
Well, maybe we shouldn't be surprised at these results when we consider that the county, for reasons I cannot even fathom, hired the same consultant to write their decarbonization framework strategy as SDG&E hired to write its path to net zero. And we should note that there's kind of a conflict of interest here. SDG&E makes most of its money now from building transmission lines, since with all these community choice aggregates that are sprouting up, people now have alternatives where to buy their power. A lot of cities and the county are offering these options to people, but even the community choice aggregates still have to deal with SDG&E to bring that power in on the power lines. Therefore, SDG&E's motivation is build as many power lines as it can. I mean, should the county be hiring an outside consultant with no ties to big utilities to reevaluate this whole thing?
Yeah, this consultant, the issue here isn't, the fundamental issue isn't so much this particular consultant as it is this project should have been competitively bid. I mean, this was handed to that consultant. It had that consultant won a competitive bidding process and gone through all of the checks and balances on conflict of interest and that type of thing. Right. That's one thing. You say, hey, I'm not pleased that someone who seems to lean toward industry won this, but they clearly are, you know, the most meritorious consultant. They were determined to be uniquely qualified. And so this project was steered to them with no competition. And that is, you need a pretty high bar when you're steering sole source contracts worth hundreds of thousands of dollars to one particular entity.
Yeah. Now, Google Project Sunroof, this was interesting, estimates that 14,700 megawatts of power could be generated from rooftop solar alone. And yet the county came up with a much lower estimate for rooftop solar and a much higher cost than what the actual cost of solar power is today. They use old numbers. They also completely omitted, I understand, parking lot solar from their decarbonization plan. Can you comment on that, Bill, please?
Right. And one of the reasons, you are now aware, Miriam, that the Protect Our Communities Foundation is really focused on this. And one of the primary reasons is just the use of erroneous information to justify a 30-year strategy, which is, wait a second, the solar, the rooftop and the parking lot potential in the county isn't a limiting factor in decarbonizing, meaning we don't run out of rooftops and parking lots. We have quite an inventory of them.
Yeah, and they've worked really well, the ones we have. I believe we're a leader in the whole state right now for that. And yet there's still more space to go.
And so the report puts in a very low number. In fact, the irony of this is that we have put in almost 2,000 megawatts of rooftop solar, and we're just scratching the surface. A lot of these rooftops are only using a small part of the roof, these net metered systems that we have out there. Mm. And based on the county's report, we're almost done. We've almost used it all that we put in 2000, but they say we've only got 3,300 megawatts and change of potential. Well, do you think so? When you look around, does it look like every space that can take a solar panel has used that space?
No, of course not. I mean, we look around at shopping malls with flat roofs and schools and lots of other places, and that's large employers, and that's not even tapping into parking lots. Imagine if every shopping center had solar covering the parking lots to keep our cars cool while they were, you know, generating power, right?
Right. I mean, the concept of developing a coherent strategy to carbonize is a good one. But if you're using obviously bad information to sidetrack rooftop solar because you don't like it and it's not going to produce a basis for building new transmission line, mm-hmm. then we're interested in that document and we want to get that document right, because this is what we're getting from the county is, well, not to worry. I mean, don't get so caught up in the numbers, Mr. Powers. I mean, this is just a conceptual thing. And you know, the fact that we're pointing all of the development into the backcountry in Imperial County, don't worry about that. We're just here to show that decarbonization is a possibility. But you know, and I know that the first document, the seminal document,
absolutely
defines the game.
Yes.
And so that's what we're fighting.
Well, there are some very real reasons why we should all worry about this. Number one, not just backcountry, but everywhere. We're all going to be paying for this, these transmission lines to nowhere. And SDG&E right now has a proposal in front of the PUC. They want to raise our rates over the next 4 years, and it's a lot of money. Would at least some of that increase not be necessary if they didn't have to build these all these transmission lines out to the desert?
Yes. I mean, this has actually finally become an issue of concern at the statewide political level. Like, I mean, all of the rate hikes and people not being able to pay because the rates are so high. We saw what happened in December where we had the gas price spike that went through the roof. And so the general public, I think, is getting the perception that these utilities are just calling the shots. I mean, whatever produces more income, they can just tell the commission, by the way, folks, we're about to build another multi-billion dollar transmission line or pipeline. And there's really nobody watching the house. And
yeah, that seems to have gone on for years under both Republican and Democratic administrations up there. It's just a really thorny problem, this this basically lack of oversight of the energy industry in general. You'd think we'd have learned from Enron, but it still goes on today with what happens with whether it's PG&E burning out towns, you know, in Northern California, or SDG&E hiking our rates that are already the highest in the country to build more transmission lines that probably aren't even needed. There's other reasons, though, why some of these industrial scale projects are a bad idea and even dangerous. And I just want to go over a few things that our reporting team here has actually personally observed and reported on right here in East County in San Diego, and also in Ocotillo, just over the county line in Imperial County. Several times, not just once, we have seen wind turbines burst into flames and caused fires. Thank goodness so far, these were in winter months. Imagine if that happened during a windy day in the dry season. And each one of these turbines, by the way, contains over 1,000 gallons of flammable lubricating oil in the case of wind. Imagine if a giant wildfire hit a bunch of those turbines and they started exploding. You know, they don't have a plan to protect against that, I have asked. That could fuel a fire that could burn all the way into the urban areas of San Diego. We have more than once seen wind turbines collapse completely and fall over, one time on a public trail. We've seen others hurl off blades weighing as much as 11 tons. Imagine if that hits somebody nearby, and some of these are near houses and trails and schools. We have seen the Department of the Interior authorize the taking. That means it's okay to kill unintentionally bighorn sheep, which are endangered. Eagles, hawks, other raptors being killed flying into the blades of the turbines. And by the way, even some types of desert solar arrays, you know, the big ones with the towers, can kill migratory birds and waterfowl. They destroy as many as 12,000 acres out here, scraping off desert topsoil, blowing up massive boulder-filled valleys like in McCain Valley, and sometimes covering up wetlands. We've also seen in the desert, they created Dust Bowl era sized dust storms. When you scrape up all that topsoil, remember the Dust Bowl, you know, in the 1930s, same thing, exacerbating asthma and respiratory problems in an area that already has the highest asthma rates in California. In Campo, we had documented stray voltage 1,000 times higher than normal, coming up through the floors into homes near a wind farm, with a cancer cluster documented in a tribal community that was exposed to this, according to a Cal State San Marcos study. Chemicals used for dust suppression washed onto people's front yards in Ocotillo after a storm. And guess what? When it dries out, it's flammable. This was a fire hazard. We've seen hydraulic fluid leak into the soil and potentially into groundwater from the wind turbines, flashing red lights on the turbines, disrupting sleep for residents. Noise and infrasound from turbines have been linked to sleep disruptions and some health issues. And of course, glare from even from giant solar fields, plus wind turbines 500 feet tall. This is taller than the tallest skyscrapers in downtown San Diego, sometimes 100 of them at a time in a project, just basically destroying the rural character, or as we've seen in what they want to build in Jacumba, basically surrounding a small town with these, you know, very large solar panels, not as big as wind, but still along a historic highway and around their community center and things. Now, rooftop and parking lot solar basically have none of those downsides other than, you know, maybe glare. So, Bill, I got to ask, are the public officials getting this yet? And if not, why not? If it's cheaper and less destructive, less harmful to build solar on rooftops and parking lots, why is that not what's being pushed for here, do you think? We lost your sound, Bill. Can you unmute, please?
Sorry about that, Miriam.
Okay.
The reason is, fundamentally, is the private monopoly investor-owned business model is driven by, and the profits are driven by building steel in the ground. It's the profit motive hasn't changed in 120 years. And we're in an era where that is a square peg in a round hole, where if you're driven by that, you're really in a tail wagging the dog situation, where what infrastructure mm-hmm. can we build that improves our bottom line, and let's use climate change and climate action as the driver for a whole new era of huge building of stuff that is no different than the stuff we were building a century ago.
Right.
But it's a real generator of funds, and let's convince. And then there's the marketing program, which is let's convince the decision makers. A lot of the general public have, I think, caught on, especially in our area. But let's convince the decision makers, either by the strength of our argument or by the strength of our wallet, that the only way we're going to get to decarbonize fast is to build giant wind farms and solar farms in remote areas, that's how we would go fast and have everyone in sheep mode going, oh, I guess that's right. Yeah. I guess that's how it works. And what you were just talking about is, well, that's how it works, where people start rising up because they see the problems with shoehorning in these giant projects. And mm-hmm. no one can imagine the scale of these projects until they're actually built. I mean,
people can say,
hey, Kumeyaay Wind, 50 megawatts, no big deal. And then you see it and you go, wow, that's a pretty big deal. And that's not even a very big project. And
exactly.
then they get bigger and bigger. And then people realize this is not a fast model.
I'm very curious. Have you happened to look up, Bill, whether anybody who makes these decisions, any of the elected officials, have taken money from SDG&E in the last year? The reason I ask, apart from the obvious potential conflict of interest, is there's a new law, nifty new law that just kicked in the first of this year. And it requires an elected official to recuse themselves from any decision if they took $250 or more in the past year from any company or other interest that would benefit from the decision.
Wow. I didn't realize such a low
threshold. Yeah, I didn't either. I just saw something about it today. Some groups suing to try to block it and claim it's unconstitutional, but it is in effect right now. And it applies to everything from school boards and water boards up to, you know, state legislature and so forth. So I just wonder about if there's any supervisors, you know, that are going to be voting on this, if any of them took SDG&E money? That would be really interesting to find out.
Yeah, I would expect if that law is enforced, there are going to be a lot of votes that have no quorum.
I said the same thing. I just said that to someone this morning. Some of these local councils and planning groups where a lot of people take developer money, you know, who knows?
Well, the challenge here is not so much the utilities. I mean, it's they do their largesse has a big impact. But one of the issues specifically around the issue of rooftop solar versus the big and remote projects is the biggest union that is working in this area, which is IBEW. I mean, IBEW, SDG&E is a union shop,
yep.
IBEW 465. They have a collective bargaining agreement with the utility that it, collective bargaining agreement says there's a loyalty clause in it. They need to support the utility and what the utility wants to do. The union's been convinced that the big project labor agreements will come faster and larger through these big projects. And so it's actually in the kind of the democratic politics of California, it's big unions are fighting against rooftop solar and supporting the utilities push to build big and remote projects. And so if it were just the utilities, it would be a lesser easier, political yeah. challenge. But when the unions are, or at least the main labor unions involved in energy, are full-throatedly in support of the utility's vision.
Could governments, whether it was the state or the county or the feds, say, they come up with a plan to incentivize using union labor or require using union labor in order to get certain benefits? You know, you want to get a rebate on your solar on your rooftop, or at least for big companies that put solar on their rooftops, to maybe require them to use union labor? Would that be one way of addressing that particular problem to get the political support from both Democrats and Republicans, or at least Democrats?
Well, interestingly enough, that's already happened. I mean, a law was passed last year that requires what are known as prevailing wage on all commercial rooftop solar projects starting January 1, 2024. Mm-hmm. And so, and I think most companies that do commercial rooftops also do residential. I don't know if it's possible for them to parse out who on their staff would get prevailing wage and who wouldn't. They might just have to pay
prevailing wage doesn't necessarily mean union workers, though, does it? You could pay a prevailing wage and not hire a union. Is that an issue for the unions to get on board with this?
I think so. I mean, the club that's been used against rooftop solar is that most of that industry is not unionized. Therefore, the union side, and this is not to, you know, make any kind of claim about the value of union labor in the United States and California.
Correct. Right.
It's more
right.
It's more this it's issue right. yeah. with rooftop versus big and remote.
Correct.
Is so that, you know, the, you know, forces that be did push through a requirement that is a challenge for some of these solar installer companies because the unions didn't actually embrace this industry when it really started going 10 or 15 years ago. So it as a result, by default, I don't know if default's the word, but it's a primarily non-unionized industry. And this requirement that prevailing wage now be paid is, I guess for the workers, is definitely a benefit to the solar installer companies, but it takes away the club that has been used until now to say, well, these solar installer companies are not providing good wages, that not providing good jobs. I mean, even though we're talking about green jobs and see all these solar companies, you know, they're paying their wage, they're without anyone revealing what people are actually getting paid, that, you know, the presumption is they're getting paid poorly and these not good jobs and they have to become union jobs or prevailing wage jobs. Well, that prevailing wage has been achieved. And so the issue of unionizing is part of that legislation. I think it's 20% of the workers have to be journeyman union on the job. And this is kind of that I'm familiar with the solar industry in San Diego. I know that several solar companies, you know, there was a real push 10 or 12 years ago during the time of the Sunrise Powerline fight, where some of the companies like Sullivan Solar Sullivan is no longer here, but it was an all union shop. And I remember talking to the owner. He said, I'm trying to encourage, you know, my union shop to get more engaged in this industry and, you know, become union solar installer companies. But I think a lot of times my observation is that it makes sense that if over time your counterparty has been a big corporation that is producing, you know, large numbers of workers needed and long-term contracts, that you're much more, it's easier to deal with that kind of a world where you're dealing with a big counterparty with a lot of jobs and a long period of time than setting it up for I'm going from home to home or commercial building to commercial building.
Right.
And the jobs are many, but smaller.
You know, another constituent of Democrats in general is environmentalists. And I think that in a rather blistering letter that she wrote to the supervisors opposing this, Billy Joe Jannen, the chair of the Campbell Lake Marina Community Planning Group, one of many planning groups that's come out against this, I should add, you know, she pointed out that they're not really calculating in the full environmental cost on this either. When you pave over a wetland, you're just, you know, you're getting rid of carbon sequestration. If you're transporting, you know, wind turbines from China overseas or something, obviously those might be produced in coal-fired power plants and you transmit over here. I don't know if that was in her letter, but I looked into that before. Some of these were coming from overseas, just massive shipping costs and so forth. So, you know, there are environmental costs that are not calculated into this. Do we know how many of the rural planning groups or community planning groups countywide have now come out against the regional decarbonization plan the county is proposing in its current form?
I do not know at this point, Miriam, the total number. I know we've reached out to a fair number. I've gotten copies of several of the letters that have gone in from community planning groups, Hakumba, Borrego Springs, to name a couple, but I do not know the total. But I'm glad to see
Campo,
that they're willing.
Campo, right. Hamul. I was at the Descanso meeting the other night. You know, I think they're on board.
That's right.
With opposing it as well. So it sounds like these rural planning groups are banding together. They're also trying to get themselves a seat on the SANDAG board, an advisory seat, because so often we see these decisions are made out there in San Diego about, you know, what they should do that has negative impacts on the rural areas. And they really ignore, you know, the real life situations. I want to read, you know, the last paragraph of Billy Joe Jannen's letter here. Again, she's the chairman of the Campbell Lake Marina Community Planning Group. And she says, finally, stop excluding regular people from having anything to say in the drafting of this framework. Your entire list of stakeholders are people who make money or not based on how it is written and implemented. We are not cattle to be herded and managed by the wealthy and elite for the sake of Sempra's bottom line or some politician's re-election bid. Our lives will be forever impacted by what is decided as a result of this process, and we deserve to have our voices heard. We are, in fact, the ultimate stakeholders.
Good letter.
Yeah, I thought it was too. It was a doozy. Bill, what else would you like to add to this that I maybe haven't specifically asked you about that people out there who are listening on our radio show or watching the video we're going to be posting on eastcountymagazine.org should know?
Well, they should know that they still have time to weigh in, even as individuals or if they're part of a group and they want to do it in that fashion. And
is there a deadline for this? I'm sure there is.
And that interesting story, and Miriam, I hear a fire engine going by. Can I continue speaking? Or
I can. I heard it for a moment, okay. But it seems to be gone now. So
there we go. And I'll credit, you know, the organizer for Protect Our Communities Foundation, Sonia Robinson, for this. Is one of the supervisors was holding a public. And so let me cut to the chase first and come back. Is that the deadline has moved from March 15th to April 5th. So April 5th is now 5 weeks out, buying more time for people to weigh in. And I think they can still weigh in officially until March 31st.
Is there a comment link you can send us, or how can people get involved? Is the next step they should let their supervisors know they're concerned about this and reach out if they have an opinion either way on the county regional decarbonization plan?
Yeah, there are a couple of ways to go. One is reach out to the supervisor and send an email, make a phone call. That's always available. There's also on their regional decarbonization framework webpage, they have, it's called an implementation playbook. And so they have left comments open on that implementation playbook until March 31st. So if a listener just goes regional decarbonization framework, implementation playbook, boom, it takes them to a webpage where it says, please comments directly into the document and we'll take those under consideration. You have until March 31st to do that, which one of the things that this is an interesting process where it seems as though as much or more effort is going into the public outreach on this document as went into actually producing it. I mean, constant workshops and public out. And so,
well, we should note that, I mean, this whole thing started when there was a little different makeup of the board. There's at least some new supervisors on there who weren't there, I believe, when this was first, you know, put forward. So basically, to recap that, listeners, there's two ways, and I would suggest that maybe people who care about this may want to do both. One is Google Regional Decarbonization Network Implementation Framework and go in and you can document in writing right there in the county document so that everybody will see it. The other way is you can reach out individually to your own supervisor or any of the other supervisors about this issue and let them know how you feel. Bill, if this does get approved the way it's written or without major changes, is the county risking legal challenges by your organization or others that you're aware of?
Potentially. And especially from the standpoint of, again, that I'm going back to this issue of all of this public outreach that they're doing on this document, is that we've been seriously engaged on review of this document, commenting on this document for almost a year. Mm-hmm. And we have not even received a written response from them on what we see as gross errors in the document. And so the reason that we're so focused on this is that this almost seems like an oddball process for a government strategy document, meaning normally, okay, we're calling now for comments on the document. We need to have them by X date. Within 45 days, you'll receive a written response to us. They called for written comments. We provided written comments, oral comments. We were in the webinar and all we got was, you know, kind of incidental, off-the-cuff comments, but nothing written down.
Almost like it fixes in somewhere. You know, the other thing people can do is you can show up either in person or virtually at any county supervisor meeting and ask to speak to them during public comments. You get your 2 or 3 minutes and people can do that so that not only your own supervisor hears, but all of them and the entire public that's listening to that or watching it on the stream countywide. So that's, I guess, one more way to get word out on this for people who may still not know about it.
Or the bold showing up on April 5th to make a public comment is a great way to be heard.
Is that at the Board of Supervisors meeting, the County Administration Building downtown?
It's currently scheduled for April 5th.
9 a.m. or do we know where it is on the agenda yet?
I do not know the time or where on the agenda for April 5th yet.
Okay. When you know, send it to us and we can publish that on East County Magazine. I'll put a story up on there, eastcountymagazine.org, with this video, and we'll update the text of that with the time of the meeting and where it is on the agenda. Once that's available, which typically is about 72 hours before the actual meeting, I think is when they have to do that.
Good.
Well, Bill, I really want to thank you very much. I'm going to give you the last word here. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with today?
Well, I really would like to encourage the listeners to engage on this because it's harder for the county to push this through when there is an upwelling of opposition to it for good reason. And the more people, especially those that are living in areas that are, for lack of a better word, targeted with development under this plan, more people that are standing up and saying no, and we want this to reflect reality, not some predetermined outcome.
Yeah. And also, I would say one of the frustrations of rural folks is that, you know, they've got their one supervisor, but there's four others that vote on this. So anyone who lives in the other four supervisors' district, even if you're on the coast or in the inner city, if you think this is unfair and you believe that, you know, rooftop and parking lot solar, which is less expensive for you, the taxpayer, in the long run, and having these SDG&E rate hikes to pay for power lines to nowhere is a problem, then, you know, you also can speak out and let your supervisors know that. They need to hear from people within their own districts, each, all five of them, I think, for us to see change on something this important.
Good counsel.
Bill, I really want to thank you again. If you tuned in late, we are speaking with Bill Powers, an engineer with the Protect Our Communities Foundation, regarding the San Diego County's proposed regional decarbonization framework. Bill, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you, Miriam.
An ice storm in January caused major damage to KNSJ's antenna high atop Monument Peak on Mount Laguna, knocking this station off the radio airways. If you're listening to our show today on the internet live stream, please donate to help get us back on the air in San Diego and East County. You can make a donation at knsj.org. And thank you for your support of local nonprofit media. We represent your interests, the public interest, not special interests.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.
Next up, we have some national news headline stories from Public News Service, and then we'll be back with more of the East County Magazine radio show, Local News.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I can tell you this much. This was 100% preventable. We call things accidents. There is no accident. Every single event that we investigate is preventable.
National Transportation Safety Board Chair Jennifer Homendy says the NTSB's preliminary report on this month's East Palestine, Ohio train derailment has not yet identified a probable cause, but it is pointing to an overheated wheel bearing that failed. Homendy says the safety board will take the rare step of hosting an investigative field hearing this spring. Local officials such as East Palestine Mayor Trent Conway says President Joe Biden's recent visit to Ukraine was, quote, the biggest slap in the face. He feels the president's place was with the people of East Palestine. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre defended the federal response amid strong criticism from former President Donald Trump.
We believe that we have had a all of government, all hands approach to this, not just with the agencies, but also with the different teams here in the White House.
Today marks the official one-year anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The United Nations General Assembly voted overwhelmingly Thursday to call for the Russian military to withdraw from Ukraine. State Department spokesperson Ned Price says he hopes today is a day free of attacks that have come to define life in Ukraine in the last year, but says that may be wishful thinking.
I think we all know there may be reason to expect otherwise, or at least reason to suspect otherwise.
The U.S. could place strict sanctions on China if it decides to support Russia with weapons and military aid. Earlier this week, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Wenbin denied that Beijing was considering the idea. On Thursday, a federal judge ruled that Trump could be questioned by attorneys in a pair of lawsuits brought by two former FBI officials who allege they were illegally targeted for retribution after the FBI investigated Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election. Peter Strzok and Lisa Page made headlines in 2017 when it was announced they were removed from a special counsel that looked into text messages criticizing Trump. Hundreds of students across Florida walked out Thursday in protest against Governor Ron DeSantis and the policies he has enacted for higher education.
Racist, sexist, anti-gay, Ron DeSantis, go away!
DeSantis has announced he plans to ban colleges and universities from having programs on diversity, equity, and inclusion, as well as critical race theory. Finally, according to the Gun Violence Archive, so far, more than 6,200 people have died from gun violence in 2023. That translates to about 116 deaths each day. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our ATRUST indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
San Diego Gas and Electric Company wants to raise your rates. The company has applied for a general rate increase over each of the next 4 years. SDG&E wants to grow revenues by $449 million, or 17.6%, in 2024. This application also includes requested increases of 10.5% in 2025, 9.2% in 2026, and another 7.7% in 2027. If approved, the first-year increase alone would hike the average monthly electric bill by $9 a month and gas by $9.60 a month, or $18.60 a month combined. That's over $220 a year more for the average ratepayer in the first year alone, with some homeowners and businesses paying far more. By 2027, the average ratepayers would pay nearly $286 more per year than today. SDG&E says it wants its customers to help pay for infrastructure projects, including putting power lines underground to prevent fires, building more electric vehicle charging stations, and modernizing the electric grid. Three hearings are slated on the proposed price hikes, conducted by an administrative law judge for the California Public Utilities Commission, or CPUC. The first two are virtual on March 6th and 15th, and the third is in person in San Diego on March 23rd at the Sherman Heights Community Center, both at 2 p.m. and again at 6 p.m. Coming on the heels of a doubling of natural gas prices locally in January, on top of utility rates that are already among the highest in the nation, SDG&E's proposal has sparked outrage. Of 395 public comments received so far on the CPUC website, all voiced anger, and 100% are opposed to raising rates. You can find links to post your comments on our website at eastcountymagazine.org or on the CPUC site at cpuc.ca.gov, or you can phone in comments on the proposed rate hike by calling 1-866-849-8390. Our site also has information on how you can participate in those public hearings. Comment online during the virtual hearings, or you can show up at that Sherman Heights Community Center hearing on March 23rd. Again, the times are 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is John Tidwell with a health alert. If you rode the trolley's blue and orange lines between June 31st and December 31st last year, you may have been exposed to tuberculosis, TB, and at risk of infection. The Orange Line services East County, running from El Cajon through La Mesa, Lemon Grove, and San Diego to Imperial. The Blue Line runs from Imperial south to the border area in San Ysidro. Metropolitan Transit System and County's Health and Human Services Agency this week announced the exposure for riders on the blue and orange lines during morning and evening commute times. Two other MTS riders with TB were reported in August and September. Additional lab testing will be used to determine if there may be linkages between these riders. Tuberculosis is an airborne disease that is transmitted from person to person through inhaling bacteria from the air. The bacteria are spread when someone sick with TB coughs, speaks, sings, or breathes. Passengers who may have been exposed are advised to consult with their medical provider or contact the San Diego County TB program, since TB is a curable disease with proper treatment, even if the disease is latent and not yet producing symptoms. A simple skin prick test or blood test can determine if you've been infected. Symptoms of active TB include persistent cough, fever, night sweats, and unexplained weight loss. But most people exposed to TB don't get sick right away. They may become ill months or even years later if their latent TB is not treated. Even people with active tuberculosis are often unaware they have the disease and may be contagious for several months before being diagnosed. Active TB can be treated with antibiotics. People who test positive for TB but who don't have symptoms should get a chest x-ray and talk to a medical provider, as they most likely have a latent TB infection. taking medicines for latent TB infection can cure the infection and keep these people from getting sick. The number of people diagnosed with active TB in San Diego County has decreased since the early 1990s and has stabilized in recent years at around 200 cases a year over the past several years. But an estimated 175,000 people in San Diego County have latent TB infection and are at risk for developing active TB without preventive treatment. You can get more information by calling the County TB Control Program at 619-692-8621.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show, and now it's time for the Sounds of History. Many San Diego County residents have visited Julian, a historic gold rush town in the Cuyamaca Mountains in San Diego's East County. Some may also know that it was founded by former Confederate soldiers after the Civil War, but most are likely unaware of the black settlers who also played key roles in the town's history. In fact, it was Fred Coleman from Kentucky, a freed slave and rancher who discovered gold in a stream that started Julian's gold rush in 1869. Coleman married a member of the Santa Isabel Indian tribe. He had previously been a miner in Northern California. The Coleman Mining District, in what is today known as Julian, was named for him, and he served as its first recorder. America Newton, a widow and formerly enslaved black woman, and her daughter Clara came to Julian from Kansas and started a laundry business that served war veterans, European immigrants, Native Americans, and newly freed African Americans. She used her work ethic to build a new life of freedom. In 1897, Albert Robinson, another black man, who was likely once a slave, founded the Hotel Robinson along with his wife, Margaret. The Julian Hotel is still in operation today and is a designated historical landmark. According to Smithsonian Magazine, Newton, Robinson, and Coleman confronted severe obstacles, racism, poverty, and lawlessness that pervaded the region, making their accomplishments even more remarkable. While African Americans in the post-Civil War era were often unable to find a job, in Julian, those who started their own businesses fared better. America Newton worked as a housekeeper for a man named James Cole back in Kansas, and he accompanied her and her daughter to California. Cole helped Newton file to own an 80-acre homestead just outside of Julian and built her a cabin next door to his own home. She ran her business from her cabin, carrying buckets of water from a spring nearby and heating irons over a grill in the fireplace, also chopping her own wood and driving a horse and buggy to deliver clean wash. And for those who stopped by her business, she'd also serve up water or a homemade liquor drink along with local gossip. Valerie Ashley, co-founder of the Julian African American Pioneers History Committee, once said, "Everybody knew America, and America knew everything about what was going on in Julian." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery. This is Miriam Raftery with an update on some events that were announced earlier this week on our show that have been postponed because of the major rain swooping into our region. Lemon Grove's Black History Month will now be on March 4th at Traganza Heritage Park in Lemon Grove. The county's Love Your Heart Community Fair at the Ramona Library has been postponed until March 11th. Fido Fest in Santee's Town Center Community Park will now be held on March 11th, and Lakeside's Touch a Truck event will be on March 19th. You can find full details on all of these events at our website at eastcountymagazine.org in our events section and on our calendar.
Wildlife crossings save lives, both human and animal, by allowing migrating species to avoid oncoming traffic and move over or under roads and freeways instead. Now, a coalition of scientists, nonprofits, and government agencies are highlighting their potential to help us adapt to climate change. The partnership has just published an open letter calling on policymakers to prioritize climate resilience as roads and bridges are built or repaired using the funds from the 2021 Infrastructure Bill. Renee Callahan with ARC Solutions co-wrote the letter.
Why don't we take advantage of this once-in-a-generation window of opportunity to not only rebuild one of the world's greatest transportation networks, and why don't we build it even better so that it works for people, wildlife, and also in the face of our changing climate?
Callahan says transportation projects should be engineered to add extra decks over bridges and to widen culverts under roads to benefit wildlife. The open letter calls for greater cooperation between tribes and local agencies. Matt Scraw with the Pew Charitable Trusts says wider culverts would improve biodiversity by allowing animals large and small to migrate from elk to toads, and the culverts would improve resiliency during extreme weather events.
We can design those structures to not only facilitate the passage of water as flooding continues to occur in the future, but we can also think about how these culverts and bridges can accommodate terrestrial wildlife movement as well.
Supporters broke ground last year on a state-of-the-art wildlife crossing over the 101 freeway in Agoura Hills, primarily to facilitate the movement of cougars. Data shows that properly sited and built, wildlife crossings can reduce mortality by 97%. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
Americans spend almost 13 hours a day using digital devices, and experts say it has the potential to strain your eyes and lead to serious health problems down the road. Blue light comes from the sun, but also from digital screens, and some medical professionals say too much of it can lead to scratchy or itchy eyes, tearing up, problems focusing, and headaches. Dr. Scott Edmonds is Chief Eye Care Officer for United Healthcare Vision. He recommends the 20/20/20 rule. Every 20 minutes, look away from the screen at something 20 feet away for at least 20 seconds.
It takes you away from the blue light so your retina can recycle. It also takes the strain off your convergence muscles, the muscles that turn your eyes in to keep them focused on the screen. When you look at 20 feet, your focusing goes to rest. Your converging muscles go to their resting point, and you get 20 seconds away from the blue light.
He also recommends that adults starting in their 20s should get a baseline eye exam so you can measure changes in the future. Ultraviolet light is damaging to the retina, and over time it is thought to contribute to age-related macular degeneration. Edmonds says experts are concerned that blue light may be just as damaging.
Blue, we always thought, was safe because it's visible. It may also be causative because it's so high energy and because these new sources emit such high levels of the blue light.
Dr. Raj Mituri with the American Academy of Ophthalmology advises frequent breaks from the screen and turning it off well before bedtime to improve sleep.
We get tired, our brain is not trying to slow down, and we don't sleep well. An excess amount of blue light at night can also decrease the amount of melatonin that our body produces and therefore affect how quickly and how easily we fall asleep.
For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.